New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Chapter 9 of The Inheritors by Joseph Conrad and Ford Madox Ford. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Mark Leder. I had a pretty bad night after that, and was not much in the mood for Fox on the morrow. The sight of her had dwarfed everything. The thought of her disgusted me with everything, made me out of conceit with the world, with that part of the world that had become my world. I wanted to get up into hers, and I could not see any way. The room in which Fox sat seemed to be hopelessly off the road, to be hopelessly off any road to any place, to be the end of a blind alley. One day I might hope to occupy such a room, in my shirt sleeves, like Fox. But that was not the end of my career, not the end that I desired. She had upset me.
"You've just missed Polehampton," Fox said. "Wanted to get hold of your atmospheres."
"Oh, damn Polehampton," I said, "and particularly damn the atmospheres."
"Willingly," Fox said, "but I told Mr. P. that you were willing if—"
"I don't want to know," I repeated. "I tell you I'm sick of the things."
"What a change," he asserted sympathetically. "I thought you would."
It struck me as disgusting that a person like Fox should think about me at all.
"Oh, I'll see it through," I said. "Who's the next?"
"We've got to have the Duke de Mersch now," he answered. "De Mersch as state founder, written as large as you can, all across the page. The moment's come, and we've got to rope it in, that's all. I've been middling good to you, you understand." He began to explain in his dark sentences. The time had come for an energetically engineered boom in de Mersch, a boom all along the line, and I was to commence the campaign. Fox had been good to me, and I was to repay him. I listened in a sort of apathetic indifference. "Oh, very well," I said. I was subconsciously aware that, as far as I was concerned, the determining factor of the situation was the announcement that de Mersch was to be in Paris. If he had been in his own particular Grand Duchy, I wouldn't have gone after him. For a moment I thought of the interview as taking place in London, but Fox, ostensibly at least, wasn't even aware of de Mersch's visit, spoke of him as being in Paris, in a flat in which he was accustomed to interview the continental financiers who took up so much of his time. I realized that I wanted to go to Paris because she was there. She had said that she was going to Paris on the morrow of yesterday. The name was pleasant to me, and it turned the scale. Fox's eyes remained upon my face.
"Do you good, eh?"
he dimly interpreted my thoughts. "A run over. I thought you'd like it, and look here. Polehampton's taking over the bi-monthly. Wants to get new blood into it, see? He takes something. I've been talking to him a short series. Aspects, that sort of thing. I tried to work myself into some sort of enthusiasm of gratitude. I knew that Fox had spoken well of me to Polehampton, as a sort of set-off.
You go and see Mr. P., he confirmed. It's really all arranged. And then get off to Paris as fast as you can and have a good time.
Have I been unusually cranky lately? I asked. Oh, you've been a little off the hooks, I thought, for the last week or so. He took up a large bottle of white mucilage, and I accepted it as a sign of dismissal.
I was touched by his solicitude for my health. It always did touch me, and I found myself unusually broad-minded in thought as I went down the terracotta front steps into the streets. For all his frank vulgarity, for all his shirt sleeves, I somehow regarded that habit of his as the final mark of the beast, and the Louis Cannes accessories. I felt a good warm, good feeling for the little man. I made haste to see Polehampton, to beard him in a sort of den that contained a number of shelves of books selected for their glittering back decoration. They gave the impression that Mr. Polehampton wished to suggest to his visitors the fitness and propriety of clothing their walls with the same gilt cloth. They gave that idea, but I think that actually Mr. Polehampton took an aesthetic delight in the gilding. He was not a publisher by nature. He had drifted into the trade and success, but beneath a polish of acquaintance retained a fine awe for a book as such. In early life he had had such shining things on a shiny table in a parlor. He had a similar awe for his daughter, who had been born after his entry into the trade, and who had the literary flavor, a flavor so pronounced that he dragged her by the heels into any conversation with us who hewed his raw material, expecting, I suppose, to cow us. For the greater good of this young lady, he'd bought the bi-monthly, one of the portentous political organs. He had, they said, ideas of forcing a seat out of the party as a recompense. It didn't matter much what was the nature of my series of articles. I was to get the atmosphere of cities as I had got those of the various individuals. I seemed to pay on those lines, and Miss Polehampton commended me. "My daughter likes your touch, you know," and his terms were decent for the man, and were offered with a flourish that indicated special benevolence and a reference to the £100. I was at a loss to account for his manner until he began to stammer out an indication. Its lines were that I knew Fox, and I knew Churchill and the Duc de Mersch and the Hour. "And those financial articles in the Hour, were they now? Were they? Was the Trans-Greenland Railway actually? That I think it would be worth one's while, in fact," and so on. I never was any good in a situation of that sort, never any good at all. I ought to have assumed blank ignorance, but the man's eyes pleaded. It seemed a tremendous matter to him. I tried to be noncommittal and said, "Of course, I haven't any right." But I had a vague, stupid sense that loyalty to Churchill demanded that I should back up a man he was backing. As a matter of fact, nothing so direct was a gate. It couldn't have been. It was something about shares in one of de Mersch's other enterprises. Polehampton was going to pick them up for nothing. And they were going to rise when the boom in de Mersch's began. Something of the sort. And the boom would begin as soon as the news of the agreement about the railway got abroad. I let him get it out of me in a way that makes the thought of that bare place with its gilt bookbacks and its three uncomfortable office chairs and the ground-glass windows through which one read the inversion of the legend Polehampton, all its gloom and its rigid lines and its pallid light, a memory of confusion. And Polehampton was properly grateful and invited me to dine with him and his phantasmal daughter, who wanted to make my acquaintance. It was like a command to a state banquet given by a palace official, and Lee would be invited to meet me. Miss Polehampton did not like Lee, but he had to be asked once a year to encourage good feeling, I suppose. The interview dribbled out on those lines. I asked if it was one of Lee's days at the office. It was not. I tried to put in a good word for Lee, but it was not very effective. Polehampton was too subject to his assistant's thorns to be responsive to praise of him. So I hurried out of the place. I wanted to be out of this medium in which my ineffectiveness threatened to proclaim itself to me. It was not a very difficult matter. I had in those days rooms in one of the political journalists' clubs, a vast mausoleum of white tiles. but a man used to pack my portmanteau very efficiently and at short notice. At the station, one of those coincidences that are not coincidences made me run against the great Callan. He was rather unhappy. Found it impossible to make an already distracted porter listen to the end of one of his sentences with 2-second waits between each word. For that reason, he brightened to see me, was delighted to find a through-journey companion who would take him on terms of greatness. In the railway carriage, divested of troublesome bags that imparted anxiety to his small face and a stagger to his walk, he swelled to his normal dimensions. "So you're going to Paris," he meditated, "for the hour." "I'm going to Paris for the hour," I agreed. "Ah," he went on, "you're going to interview the elective Grand Duke." "We call him the Duc de Mersch," I interrupted, flippantly. It was a matter of nuances. The elective Grand Duke was a philanthropist and estate founder. The Duc de Mersch was the hero as financier. "Of Holstein-Launewitz," Callan ignored. The title slipped over his tongue like the last drops of some inestimable oily vintage. "I might have saved you the trouble. I'm going to see him myself." "You," I italicized. It struck me as phenomenal and rather absurd that everybody that I came across should, in some way or other, be mixed up with this portentous philanthropist. It was as if a fisherman was drawing in a ground line baited with hundreds of hooks. He had a little offended air. "He, or I should say, a number of people interested in a philanthropic society, have asked me to go to Greenland." "Do they want to get rid of you?" I asked flippantly. I was made to know my place. "My dear fellow," Callan said, in his most deliberate, most Olympian tone, "I believe you're entirely mistaken. I've been informed that the Système Groenlandais is one of the healthiest places in the polar regions. There are interested persons who..." "So I've heard," I interrupted. "But I can assure you I've heard nothing but good of the system and its philanthropists. I meant nothing against them. I was only astonished that you should go to such a place." "I have been asked to go upon a mission," he explained seriously, "to ascertain what the truth about the system really is. It is a new country with, I am assured, a great future in store. A great deal of English money has been invested in its securities, and naturally, great interest is taken in its affairs." "So it seems," I said. "I seem to run upon it at every hour of the day and night." "Ah, yes," Callan rhapsodized. "It has a great future in store, a great future. The Duke is a true philanthropist. He has taken infinite pains, infinite pains. He wished to build up a model state, the model protectorate of the world, a place where perfect equality shall obtain for all races, all creeds, and all colors. You would scarcely believe how he has worked to ensure the happiness of the native races. He founded the Great Society to protect the Eskimos, the Society for the Regeneration of the Arctic Regions, the SRAR, as you called it, and now he is only waiting to accomplish his greatest project, the Trans-Greenland Railway. When that is done, he will hand over the system to his own people. That is the act of a great man." "Ah, yes," I said. "Well," Callan began again, but suddenly paused. "By the by, this must go no farther," he said anxiously. "I will let you have full particulars when the time is ripe." "My dear Callan," I said touchily, "I can hold my tongue." He went off a tangent. "I don't want you to take my word. I haven't seen it yet. But I feel assured about it myself. The most distinguished people have spoken to me in its favor. The celebrated traveler, Aston, spoke of it with tears in his eyes. He was the first governor general, you know. Of course, I should not take any interest in it if I were not satisfied as to that. It is precisely because I feel that the thing is one of the finest monuments of a grand century that I am going to lend it the weight of my pen. I quite understand, I assured him. Then, solicitously, I hope they don't expect you to do it for nothing. Oh, dear no, Callan answered. Ah, well, I wish you luck, I said. They couldn't have got a better man to win over the national conscience. I suppose it comes to that. Callan nodded. I fancy I have the ear of the public, he said. He seemed to get satisfaction from the thought. The train entered Folkestone Harbour. The smell of the sea and the easy send of the boat put a little heart into me, but my spirits were on the downgrade. Callan was a trying companion. The sight of him stirred uneasy emotions. The sound of his voice jarred. "Are you coming to the Grand?" he said, as we passed Saint Denis. "My God, no," I answered hotly. "I'm going across the river." "Ah," he murmured, "the Quartier Latin. I wish I could come with you, but I have my reputation to think of. You'd be surprised how people get to hear of my movements. Besides, I'm a family man." I was agitatedly silent. The train steamed into the glare of the electric lights, and getting into a fiacre, I breathed again. I seemed to be at the entrance of a new life, a better sort of paradise, during that drive across the night city. In London, one is always a passenger. In Paris, one has reached a goal. The crowds on the pavements, under the plane trees, in the black shadows, in the white glare of the open spaces, are at leisure. They go nowhere, seek nothing beyond. We crossed the river, the unwinking towers of Notre Dame towering pallidly against the dark sky behind us, rattled into the new light of the resuming boulevard, turned up a dark street, and came to a halt before a half-familiar shut door. You know how one wakes the sleepy concierge, how one takes one's candle, climbs up hundreds and hundreds of smooth stairs, following the slipshod footfalls of a half-awakened guide upward through Rembrandt's own shadows, and how one's final sleep is sweetened by the little inconveniences of a strange bare room and of a strange hard bed. End of The Inheritors, Chapter 9, by Joseph Conrad and Ford Madox Ford. Chapter 10 of The Inheritors, by Joseph Conrad and Ford Madox Ford. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Mark Leder. Before noon of the next day, I was ascending the stairs of a new house in which the Duke had his hermitage. There was an air of secrecy in the broad publicity of the carpeted stairs that led to his flat, a hush in the atmosphere, in the street itself, a glorified cul-de-sac that ran into the bustling life of the Italians. It had the sudden sluggishness of a backwater. One seemed to have grown suddenly deaf in the midst of the rattle. There was an incredible suggestion of silence, the silence of a private detective, in the mien of the servant who ushered me into a room. He was the English servant of the theatre, the English servant that foreigners affect. The room had a splendor of its own, not a cheaply vulgar splendor, but the vulgarity of the most lavish plush and purple kind. The air was heavy, killed by the scent of exotic flowers, darkened by curtains that suggested the voluminous velvet backgrounds of certain old portraits. The Duc de Mersch had carried with him into this place of retirement the taste of the new palace, that show place of his that was the stupefaction of swarms of honest tourists. I remembered soon enough that the man was a philanthropist,
that he might be an excellent man of heart and indifferent of taste. He must be. But I was prone to be influenced by things of this sort, and felt depressed at the thought that so much of royal excellence should weigh so heavily in the wrong scale of the balance of the applied arts. I turned my back on the room and gazed at the blazing white decorations of the opposite house fronts. A door behind me must have opened, for I heard the sounds of a concluding tirade in a high-pitched voice.
Et quand un duc de France, je ne m'en fiche pas mal, moi,
it said in an accent curiously compounded of the foreign and the coulisse. A muttered male remonstrance ensued, and then, with disconcerting clearness,
Grand jeu, un chigan. Eh bien, il est temps, et moi, j'entends, moi aussi. Tu veux me jouer contre elle, le grand jeu. Pas. Console-toi avec elle, mon vieux. Je ne veux plus de toi. Tu m'as donné de tes sales rentes grandes landoises, et je n'ai pas pu la vendre. Et vieux farceur, tu vas voir ce que j'en vais faire.
A glorious creature, a really glorious creature, came out of an adjoining room. She was as frail, as swaying as a garden lily. Her great blue eyes turned irefully upon me. Her bowed lips parted, her nostrils quivered.
Et quant à vous, Monsieur Grandjeu et Chingan, she began, je vais vous donner mon idée à moi.
I did not understand the situation in the least, but I appreciated the awkwardness of it. The world seemed to be standing on its head. I was overcome, but I felt for the person in the next room. I did not know what to do. Suddenly I found myself saying, I am extremely sorry, madam, but I don't understand French. An expression of more intense vexation passed into her face, her beautiful face. I fancy she wished intensely to give me the benefit of her idée à elle. She made a quick, violent gesture of disgusted contempt and turned toward the half-open door from which she had come. She began again to dilate upon the little weaknesses of the person behind, when silently and swiftly it closed. We heard the lock click. With extraordinary quickness, she had her mouth at the keyhole.
Pig! Pig! She enunciated.
Then she stood to her full height. Her face became calm, her manner stately. She glided halfway across the room, paused, looked at me and pointed toward the unmoving door.
Pig.
Pig, she explained mysteriously. I think she was warning me against the wiles of the person behind the door. I gazed into her great eyes. I understand, I said gravely. She glided from the room. For me, the incident supplied a welcome touch of comedy. I had leisure for thought. The door remained closed. It made the Duke a more real person for me. I had regarded him as a rather tiresome person in whom a pompous philanthropism took the place of human feelings. It amused me to be called Le Grand Jeu. It amused me, and I stood in need of amusement. Without it, I might never have written the article on the Duke. I had started out that morning in a state of nervous irritation. I had wanted more than ever to have done with the thing, with the hour, with journalism, with everything. But this little new experience buoyed me up, set my mind working in less morbid lines. I began to wonder whether de Mersch would funk or whether he would take my non-comprehension of the woman's tirades as a thing assured. The door at which I had entered, by which she had left, opened. He must have impressed me in some way or other that evening at the Churchills. He seemed a very stereotyped image in my memory. He spoke just as he had spoken, moved his hands just as I expected him to move them. He called for no modification of my views of his person. As a rule, one classes a man so-and-so at first meeting, modifies the classification at each subsequent one, and so on. He seemed to be all affability of an adipose turn. He had the air of the man of the world among men of the world, but none of the unconscious reserve of manner that one expects to find in the temporarily great. He had in its place a kind of sub-sulkiness, as if he regretted the pedestal from which he had descended. In his slow commercial English, he apologized for having kept me waiting. He'd been taking the air of this fine morning, he said. He mumbled the words with his eyes on my waistcoat, with an air that accorded rather ill with the semblance of portentous probity that his beard conferred on him. But he set an eyeglass in his left eye immediately afterward, and looked straight at me as if in challenge. With a smiling, "Don't mention," I tried to demonstrate that I met him halfway.
"You want to interview me," he said blandly. "I am only too pleased. I suppose it is about my Arctic schemes that you wish to know. I will do what I can to inform you. You perhaps remember what I said when I had the pleasure of meeting you at the house of the Right Honorable Mr. Churchill. It has been the dream of my life to leave behind me a happy and contented state, as much as laws and organization can make one. This is what I should most like the English to know of me." He was a dull talker. I suppose that philanthropists and state founders kept their best faculties for their higher pursuits. I imagined the low receding forehead and the pink-nailed fleshy hands to belong to a new Solon, a latter-day Aeneas. I tried to work myself into the properly enthusiastic frame of mind. After all, it was a great work that he had undertaken. I was too much given to dwell upon intellectual gifts. These the Duke seemed to lack. I credited him with having let them be merged in his one noble idea. He furnished me with statistics. They had laid down so many miles of railways, used so many engines of British construction. They had taught the natives to use and to value sewing machines and European costumes. So many hundred of English younger sons had gone to make their fortunes and, incidentally, to enlighten the Eskimos. So many hundreds of French, Germans, Greeks, Russians. All these lived and moved in harmony, employed, happy, free laborers, protected by the most rigid laws. Man-eating, fetish worship, slavery had been abolished, stamped out. The great International Society for the Preservation of Polar Freedom watched over all, suggested new laws, modified the old. The country was unhealthy, but not to men of clean lives. Hominibus bonae voluntatis. It asked for no others. "I have had to endure much misrepresentation. I have been called names," the Duke said. The figure of a lady danced before my eyes, lithe, supple, a statue endued with the motion of a serpent. I seemed to see her sculptured white hand pointing to the closed door. "Ah, yes," I said, "but one knows the people that call you names." "Well, then," he answered, "it is your task to make them know the truth. Your nation has so much power. If it will only realize." "I will do my best," I said. I saw the apotheosis of the press, a press that makes a state founder suppliant to a man like myself. For he had the tone of a deprecating petitioner. I stood between himself and a people, the arbiter of the peoples, of the kings of the future. I was nothing, nobody. Yet here I stood in communion with one of those who changed the face of continents. He had need of me, of the power that was behind me. It was strange to be alone in that room with that man, to be there just as I might be in my own little room alone with any other man. I was not unduly elated, you must understand. It was nothing to me. I was just a person elected by some suffrage of accidents. Even in my own eyes, I was merely a symbol, the sign visible of incomprehensible power. "I will do my best," I said. Ah, yes, do, he said. Mr. Churchill told me how nicely you can do such things. I said that it was very kind of Mr. Churchill. The tension of the conversation was relaxed. But Duke asked if I had yet seen my aunt. I had forgotten her, I said. Oh, you must see her, he said. She is a most remarkable lady. She is one of my relaxations. All Paris talks about her, I can assure you. I had no idea, I said. Oh, cultivate her, he said. You will be amused. I will, I said, as I took my leave. I went straight home to my little room above the roofs. I began at once to write my article, working at high pressure, almost hysterically. I remember that place and that time so well. In moments of emotion, one gazes fixedly at things, hardly conscious of them. Afterward, one remembers. I can still see the narrow room, the bare, brown, discolored walls, the incongruous marble clock on the mantelpiece, the single rickety chair that swayed beneath me. I could almost draw the tortuous pattern of the faded cloth that hid the round table at which I sat. The ink was thick, pale, and sticky. The pen spluttered. I wrote furiously, anxious to be done with it. Once I went and leaned over the balcony, trying to hit on a word that would not come. Miles down below, little people crawled over the cobbled street. Little carts rattled, little workmen let down casks into a cellar. It was all very gray, small, and clear. Through the open window of an opposite garret, I could see a sculptor working at a colossal clay model. In his white blouse, he seemed big, out of all proportion to the rest of the world. Level with my eyes, there were flat lead roofs and chimneys. On one of these was scrawled, in big, irregular, blue-painted letters, Abbat Coignet. Great clouds began to loom into view over the housetops, rounded, toppling masses of gray, lit up with sullen orange against the pale, limpid blue of the sky. I stood and looked at all these objects. I had come out here to think. Thoughts had deserted me. I could only look. The clouds moved imperceptibly, fatefully onward. A streak of lightning tore them apart. They whirled like tortured smoke and grew suddenly black. Large spots of rain with jagged edges began to fall on the lead floor of my balcony. I turned into the twilight of my room and began to write. I can still feel the tearing of my pen point on the coarse paper. It was a hindrance to thought, but my flow of words ignored it. Gained impetus from it, as a stream does at the breaking of a dam. I was writing a paean to a great colonizer. That sort of thing was in the air then. I was drawn into it, carried away by my subject. Perhaps I let it do so because it was so little familiar to my lines of thought. It was fresh ground, and I reveled in it. I committed myself to that kind of emotional, lyrical outburst that one dislikes so much on rereading. I was half conscious of the fact, but I ignored it. A thunderstorm was over, and there was a moist, sparkling freshness in the air when I hurried with my copy to the Hour office in the Avenue de l'Opéra. I wished to be rid of it, to render impossible all chance of revision on the morrow. I wanted, too, to feel elated. I expected it. It was a right. At the office I found the foreign correspondent, a little cosmopolitan Jew whose eyebrows began their growth on the bridge of his nose. He was effusive and familiar, as the rest of his kind. "Hello, Granger," was his greeting. I was used to regarding myself as fallen from a high estate. But I was not yet so humble in spirit as to relish being called Granger by a stranger of his stamp. I tried to freeze him politely. "Read your stuff in the Hour," was his rejoinder. "Jolly good, I call it. Been doing old Redbeard? Let's have a look. Yes, yes, that's the way. That's the real thing, I call it. Must have bored you to death. Old de Mersch, I mean. I ought to have had the job, you know. My business, interviewing people in Paris. But I don't mind. Much rather you did it than I. You'd do it a heap better.
I murmured thanks. There was a pathos about the sleek little man, a pathos that is always present in the type. He seemed to be trying to assume a deprecating equality.
"Where are you going tonight?" he asked with sudden effusiveness.
I was taken aback. One is not used to being asked these questions after 5 minutes' acquaintance. I said that I had no plans.
"Look here," he said, brightening up. "Come and have dinner with me at Breguet's, and look in at the opera afterward. We'll have a real nice chat."
I was too tired to frame an adequate excuse. Besides, the little man was as eager as a child for a new toy. We went to Breguet's and had a really excellent dinner.
"Always come here," he said. "One meets a lot of swells. It runs away with a deal of money. But I don't care to do things on the cheap. Not for the hour, you know. You can always be certain when I say that I have a thing from a senator that he is a senator and not an old woman in a paper kiosk. Most of them do that sort of thing, you know."
"I always wondered," I said mildly.
"That's de Sourdame," I nodded to as we came in. "And that old chap there is Plevy, the affair man, you know. I must have a word with him in a minute, if you'll excuse me."
He began to ask affectionately after the health of the excellent fox, asked if I saw him often, and so on and so on. I divined with amusement that it was pleasurable, for the little man had his own little axe to grind, and thought I might take a turn at the grindstone if he managed me well. So he nodded to de Sourdame of the Austrian embassy, and had his word with Plevy, and rejoiced to have impressed me. I could see him bubble with happiness and purr. He proposed that we should stroll as far as the paper kiosk that he patronized habitually. It was kept by a fellow Israelite, a snuffy little old woman. I understood that in the joy of his heart he was for expanding, for wasting a few minutes on a stroll.
"Haven't stretched my legs for months," he explained.
We strolled there through the summer twilight. It was so pleasant to saunter through the young summer night. There were so many little things to catch the eyes, so many of the little things down near the earth. Expressions on faces of the passers, the set of a collar, the quaint foreign tightness of waist of a good bourgeoise who walked arm in arm with her perspiring spouse. The gilding on the statue of Joan of Arc had a pleasant littleness of Philistinism. The arcades of the Rue de Rivoli broke up the gray light pleasantly, too. I remembered a little shop, a little Greek affair with a window full of pinchbeck, where I'd been given a false 5-franc piece years and years ago. The same villainous old Levantine stood in the doorway. Perhaps the fez that he wore was the same fez. The little old woman that we strolled to was bent nearly double. Her nose touched her wares as often as not. Her mittened hands sought quiveringly the papers that the correspondent asked for. I liked him the better for his solicitude for this forlorn piece of flotsam of his own race.
"Always come here," he exclaimed. "One gets into habits. Very honest woman, too. You can be certain of getting your change. If you're a stranger, you can't be sure that they won't give you Italian silver, you know."
"Oh, I know," I answered. I knew, too, that he wished me to purchase something. I followed the course of her groping hands, caught sight of the Revue Rouge, and remembered that it contained something about Greenland. I helped myself to it, paid for it, and received my just change. I felt that I had satisfied the little man, and felt satisfied with myself.
"I want to see Rede's article on Greenland," I said. "Oh, yes," he explained, once more exhibiting himself in the capacity of the man who knows. "Rede gives it to them. Rather a lark, I call it, though you mustn't let old de Mersch know you read him. Rede got sick of Cochin and tried Greenland. He's getting touched by the whites, you know. They say that the priests don't like the way the système is playing into the hands of the Protestants and the English government. So they set Rede on to write it down.
He's going in for mysticism and all that sort of thing, just like all these French jokers are doing. Got deuced thick with that lot in the Faubourg Saint-Germain. Some relation of yours, ain't they? Rather a lark, that lot. Quite the thing just now. Everyone goes there, old de Mersch, too. Have frightful rows sometimes. Such a mixed lot, you see. The good little man rattled amiably along beside me. Seems quite funny to be buying books, he said. I haven't read a thing I've bought, not for years. We reached the opera in time for the end of the first act. It was Aida, I think. My little friend had a free pass all over the house. I had not been in it for years. In the old days, I'd always seen the stage from a great height, craning over people's heads in a sultry twilight. Now I saw it on a level, seated at my ease. I had only the power of the press to thank for the change. "Come here as often as I can," my companion said. "Can't do without music when it's to be had." Indeed, he had the love of his race for it. It seemed to soften him, to change his nature, as he sat silent by my side. But the closing notes of each scene found him out in the cool of the corridors, talking, and being talked to by anyone that would vouchsafe him a word. "Pick up a lot here," he explained. After the finale, we leaned over one of the side balconies to watch the crowd streaming down the marble staircases. It's a scene that I never tire of. There's something so fantastically tawdry in the colored marble of the architecture. It is for all the world like a triumph of ornamental soapwork. One expects to smell the odors. And the torrent of humanity pouring liquidly aslant through the mirror-like light and the spaciousness. Yes, it is fantastic somehow. Ironical, too. I was watching the devious passage of a rather drunken, gigantic, florid Englishman, wondering, I think, how he would reach his bed.
"That must be a relation of yours," the correspondent said, pointing.
My glance followed the line indicated by his pale finger. I made out the glorious beard of a Duc de Mersch. On his arm was an old lady whom he seemed to pay deferential attention. His head was bent on one side. He was smiling frankly. A little behind them on the staircase there was a space. Perhaps I was mistaken. Perhaps there was no space. I don't know. I was only conscious of a figure, an indescribably clear-cut woman's figure, gliding down the way. It had a coldness, a self-possession, a motion of its own. In that clear, transparent, shimmering light, every little fold of the dress, every little shadow of the white arms, the white shoulders, came up to me. The face turned up to meet mine. I remember so well the light shining down on the face, not a shadow anywhere, not a shadow beneath the eyebrows, the nostrils, the waves of hair. It was a vision of light, threatening, sinister. She smiled, her lips parted. "You come to me tomorrow," she said. Did I hear the words? Did her lips merely form them? She was far, far down below me. The air was alive with the rustling of feet, of garments, of laughter, full of sounds that made themselves heard, full of sounds that would not be caught. "You come to me tomorrow." The old lady on the Duc de Mersch's arm was obviously my aunt. I did not see why I should not go to them tomorrow. It struck me suddenly and rather pleasantly that this was, after all, my family. This old lady actually was a connection more close than anyone else in the world. As for the girl, to all intents and in everyone else's eyes, she was my sister. I cannot say I disliked having her for my sister, either. I stood looking down upon them and felt less alone than I had done for many years. A minute scuffle of the shortest duration was taking place beside me. There were a couple of men at my elbow. I don't in the least know what they were. Perhaps marquises, perhaps railway employees. One can never tell over there. One of them was tall and blonde, with a heavy, bow-shaped red mustache, Irish in type. The other of no particular height, excellently groomed, dark, and exemplary. I knew he was exemplary from some detail of costume that I can't remember. His gloves were a strip of silk down the sides of his trousers, something of the sort. The blonde was saying something that I did not catch. I heard the words de Mersch and Anglais, and saw the dark man turn his attention to the little group below. Then I caught my own name mispronounced in somewhat of a stumbling block to a high-pitched, contemptuous intonation. The little correspondent who was on my other arm started visibly and moved swiftly behind my back. "Messieurs," he said in an urgent whisper, and drew them to a little distance. I saw him say something, saw them pivot to look at me, shrug their shoulders and walk away. I didn't in the least grasp the significance of the scene, not then. "What's the matter?" I asked my returning friend. "Were they talking about me?" He answered nervously,
"Oh, it was about your Aunt Salon, you know. They might have been going to say something awkward. One never knows."
"They really do talk about it, then," I said. "I've a good mind to attend one of their exhibitions."
"Why, of course," he said. "You ought. I really think you ought."
"I'll go tomorrow," I answered. End of The Inheritors, Chapter 10, by Joseph Conrad and Ford Madox Ford. Chapter 11 of The Inheritors, by Joseph Conrad and Ford Madox Ford. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Mark Leader. I couldn't get to sleep that night, but lay and tossed, lit my candle and read, and so on, forever and ever, for an eternity. I was confoundedly excited. There were 100 things to be thought about, clamoring to be thought about, out-clamoring the recurrent chimes of some near clock. I began to read the article by Rade in the Revue Rouge, the one I'd bought of the old woman in the kiosk. It upset me a good deal, that article. It gave away the whole Greenland show so completely that the ecstatic bosh I had just dispatched to the hour seemed impossible. I suppose the good Rade had his axe to grind, just as I had had to grind the state founders. But Rade's axe didn't show. I was reading about an inland valley, a broad, shadowy, gray thing, immensely broad, immensely shadowy, winding away between immense, half-invisible mountains into the silence of an unknown country. A little band of men, microscopic figures in that immensity, in those mists, crept slowly up it. A man among them was speaking. I seemed to hear his voice, low, monotonous, overpowered by the wan light and the silence and the vastness. And how well it was done, how the man could write, how skillfully he made his points. There was no slosh about it, no sentiment. The touch was light, in places even gay. He saw so well the romance of that dun band that had cast remorse behind, that had no return, no future, that spread desolation desolately. This was merely a review article, a thing that in England would have been unreadable, the narrative of a nomad of some genius. I could never have written like that. I should have spoilt it somehow. It set me tingling with desire, with the desire that transcends the sexual, the desire for the fine phrase, for the right word, for all the other intangibles. And I had been wasting all this time, had been writing my inanities. I must go away, must get back, right back to the old road, must work. There was so little time. It was unpleasant, too, to have been mixed up in this affair, to have been trepanned into doing my best to help it on its foul way. God knows I had little of the humanitarian in me. If people must murder in the byways of an immense world, they must do murder and pay the price. But that I should have been mixed up in such was not what I had wanted. I must have done with it all, with all this sort of thing. Must get back to my old self, must get back. I seem to hear the slow words of a Duc de Mersch.
We have increased exports by so much, the imports by so much. We have protected the natives, have kept their higher interests very present in our minds. And through it all, we have never forgotten the mission entrusted to us by Europe, to remove the evil of darkness from the earth, to root out barbarism with its nameless horrors, whose existence has been a blot on our consciences. Men of good will and self-sacrifice are doing it now, are laying down their priceless lives to root out. Of course, they were rooting them out. It didn't matter to me. One supposes that sort of native exists for that sort of thing, to be rooted out by men of goodwill with careers to make. The point was that that was what they were really doing out there, rooting out the barbarians as well as the barbarism and proving themselves worthy of their hire. And I'd been writing them up, and was no better than the farcical governor of a department who would write on the morrow to protest that that was what they did not do. You see, I had a sort of personal pride in those days, and preferred to think of myself as a decent person. I knew that people would say the same sort of thing about me that they said about all the rest of them. I couldn't very well protest. I had been scratching the backs of all sorts of creatures, out of friendship, out of love, for all sorts of reasons. This was only a sort of last straw, or perhaps it was the sight of her that had been the last straw. It seemed naively futile to have been wasting my time over Mrs. Hartley and those she stood for when there was something so different in the world, something so like a current of east wind. That vein of thought kept me awake, and a worst came to keep it company. The men from the next room came home, students, I suppose. They talked gaily enough, their remarks interspersed by the thuds of falling boots and the other incomprehensible noises of the night. Through the flimsy partition, I caught half sentences in that sort of French intonation that is so impossible to attain. It reminded me of the voices of the two men at the opera. I began to wonder what they'd been saying, what they could have been saying that concerned me and affected the little correspondent to interfere. Suddenly the thing dawned upon me with the startling clearness of a figure in a complicated pattern, a clearness from which one cannot take one's eyes. It threw everything, the whole world, into more unpleasant relations with me than even the Greenland affair. They had not been talking about my aunt and her salon, but about my sister. She was de Mersch's Anglaise. I did not believe it, but probably all Paris, the whole world, said she was. And to the whole world, I was her brother. Those two men who had looked at me over their shoulders had shrugged and said, "Oh, he's..." And the whole world, wherever I went, would whisper in asides, "Don't you know Granger? He's the brother de Mersch employs him." I began to understand everything. The woman in de Mersch's room with her Ischingang Grangeur, the deference of a little Jew, the man who knew. He knew that I, who patronized him, was a person to stand well with because of my sister's hold over de Mersch. I wasn't, of course, but you can't understand how the whole thing maddened me all the same. I hated the world. This world of people who whispered and were whispered to, of men who knew and men who wanted to know. The shadowy world of people who didn't matter, but whose eyes and voices were all round one and did somehow matter. I knew well enough how it had come about. It was de Mersch, the state founder with his shamed face and his pallid hands. She'd been attracted by his air of greatness, by his elective grand dukedom, by his protestations. Women are like that. She'd been attracted and didn't know what she was doing, didn't know what the world was over here, how people talked. She'd been excited by the whirl and flutter of it, and perhaps she didn't care. The thing must come to an end, however. She had said that I should go to her on the morrow. Well, I would go, and I would put a stop to this. I had suddenly discovered how very much I was a Granger of Etchingham. After all, I had family traditions in graves behind me. And for the sake of all these people whose one achievement had been the making of a good name, I had to intervene now. After all, bon sang ne does not get itself talked about in that way. The early afternoon of the morrow found me in a great room, a faded somber salon of the house my aunt had taken in the Faubourg Saint-Germain. Numbers of strong-featured people were talking in groups among the tables and chairs of a time before the revolution. I rather forget how I had got there and what had gone before. I must have arisen late and passed the intervening hours in a state of trepidation. I was going to see her, and I was like a cub in love, with a man's place to fill. It was a preposterous state of things that set the solid world in a whirl. Once there, my eyes suddenly took in things. I had a sense of her standing by my side. She had just introduced me to my aunt, a heavy-featured, tired-eyed village tyrant. She was so obviously worn out, so obviously not what she had been, that her face would have been pitiful but for its immovable expression of class pride. The Grangers of Etchingham, you see, were so absolutely at the top of their own particular kind of tree that it was impossible for them to meet anyone who was not an inferior. A man might be a cabinet minister, might even be a prince, but he couldn't be a Granger of Etchingham, couldn't have such an assortment of graves, each containing a Granger behind his back. The expression didn't even lift for me who had. It couldn't. It was fixed there. One wondered what she was doing in this galère. It seemed impossible that she should interest herself in the restoration of the Bourbons. They were all very well, but they weren't even English, let alone a county family. I figured it out that she must have set her own village so much in order that there remained nothing but the setting in order of the rest of the world. Her bored eyes wandered sleepily over the assemblage. They seemed to have no preferences for any of them. They rested on the vacuously Bonaparte prince, on the moribund German Jesuit to whom he was listening, on the darkly supple young Spanish priest, on the rosy-gilled English passionist, on Rédé, the writer of that article in the Revue Rouge, who was talking to a compatriot in one of the tall windows. She seemed to accept the saturnine-looking men, the political women who all spoke a language not their own, with an accent and a fluency, and a dangerous faraway smile and a display of questionable teeth all their own. She seemed to class the political with the pious, the obvious adventurer with the seeming fanatic. It was amazing to me to see her there, standing with her county family self-possession in the midst of so much that was questionable. She offered me no explanation. I had to find one for myself. We stood and talked in the center of the room. It did not seem a place in which one could sit. "Why have you never been to see me?" she asked languidly. "I might never have known of your existence if it had not been for your sister." My sister was standing at my side, you must remember. I don't suppose that I started, but I made my aunt no answer. "Indeed," she went on, "I should never have known that you had a sister. Your father was so very peculiar. From the day he married, my husband never heard a word from him." "They were so very different," I said listlessly.
Ah, yes, she answered, brothers so often are. She sighed apropos of nothing. She continued to utter disjointed sentences from which I gathered a skeleton history of my soi-disant sister's introduction of herself and of her pretensions. She had, it seemed, casually introduced herself at some garden party or function of the sort, had represented herself as a sister of my own to whom a maternal uncle had left a fabulous fortune. She herself had suggested her being sheltered under my aunt's roof as a singularly welcome paying guest. She herself, too, had suggested the visit to Paris, and had hired the house from a degenerate Duc de Luynes, who preferred the delights of an appartement in the less lugubrious Avenue Marceau. "We have tastes so much in common," my aunt explained, as she moved away to welcome a new arrival. I was left alone with the woman who called herself my sister. We stood a little apart. Each little group of talkers in the vast room seemed to stand just without earshot of the next. I had my back to the door, my face to her. "And so you have come," she said, maliciously, it seemed to me. It was impossible to speak in such a position, in such a place, impossible to hold a discussion on family affairs when the diminutive Irishwoman with two mobile eyebrows and a couple of gigantic, raw-boned, lugubrious Spaniards were in a position to hear anything that one uttered above a whisper. One might want to raise one's voice. Besides, she was so terrible, there was no knowing what she might not say. She so obviously did not care what the Irish or the Spaniards or the Jesuits heard or thought, that I was forced to the mortifying conclusion that I did. "Oh, I've come," I answered. I felt as outrageously out of it as one does at a suburban hop where one does not know one animal of the menagerie. I did not know what to do or what to say or what to do with my hands. I was pervaded by the unpleasant idea that all those furtive eyes were upon me, gauging me because I was the brother of a personality. I was concerned about the fit of my coat and my boots, and all the while I was in a furious temper. My errand was important. She stood looking at me, a sinuous, brilliant thing, with a light in her eyes half challenging, half openly victorious. "You have come," she said, and I became singularly afraid of her and wanted to stop her mouth. She might be going to say anything. She overpowered me so that I actually dwindled into the gawkiness of extreme youth. I became a goggled-eyed, splay-footed boy again and made a boy's desperate effort after a recovery at one stroke of an ideal standard of dignity. "I must have a word with you," I said, remembering. She made a little gesture with her hand, signifying, "I am here." "But in private," I added. "Oh, everything's in private here," she said. I was silent. "I must," I added after a time. "I can't retire with you," she said. "It would look odd, you'd say, wouldn't you?" I shrugged my shoulders in intense irritation. I didn't want to be burlesqued. A flood of fresh people came into the room. I heard a throaty ahem behind me. The Duc de Mersch was introducing himself to notice. It was as I had thought. The man was an habitué with his well-cut clothes, his air of protestation and his tremendous golden poll. He was the only sunlight that the gloomy place rejoiced in. He bowed low over my oppressor's hand, smiled upon me, and began to utter platitudes in English. "Oh, you may speak French," she said carelessly. "But your brother," he answered. "I understand French very well," I said. I was in no mood to spare him embarrassments. Wanted to show him that I had a hold over him and knew he wasn't the proper person to talk to a young lady. He glared at me haughtily. "But yesterday," he began in a tone that burlesqued august displeasure. I was wondering what he had looked like on the other side of the door,
whilst that lady had been explaining his nature to me. "Yesterday I wished to avoid embarrassments," I said. "I was to represent your views about Greenland. I might have misunderstood you in some important matter."
I see, he said conciliatorily. "Yesterday we spoke English for the benefit of the British public. When we speak French, we are not in public, I hope." He had a semi-supplicating manner.
"Everything's rather too much in public here," I answered. My part, as I imagined it, was that of a British brother defending his sister from questionable attentions, the person who tries to show the man he isn't wanted. But de Mersch didn't see the matter in that light at all. He could not, of course. He was as much used to being purred to as my aunt to looking down on non-county persons. He seemed to think I was making an incomprehensible insular joke and laughed non-committally. It wouldn't have been possible to let him know he wasn't wanted.
"Oh, you needn't be afraid of my brother," she said suddenly. "He's quite harmless. He's even going to give up writing for the papers except when we want him."
The Duke turned from me to her, smiled and bowed. His smile was inane, but he bowed very well. He'd been groomed into that sort of thing, or had it in the blood.
"We work together still?" he asked.
"Why not?" she answered. A hubbub of angry voices raised itself behind my back. It was one of the contretemps that made the Salon Grand Jeu famous throughout the city.
"You forced yourself upon me. Did I say anywhere that you were responsible? If it resembles your particular hell upon earth, what is that to me? You do worse things, you yourself, monsieur. Haven't I seen it?
The Duc de Mersch looked swiftly over his shoulder toward the window.
"They seem to be angry there," he said nervously. "Had not something better be done, Miss Granger?"
Miss Granger followed the direction of his eyes.
"Why," she said, "we're used to these differences of opinion. Besides, it's only Monsieur Adet. He's forever at war with someone or other."
"He ought to be shown the door," the Duke grumbled.
"Oh, as for that," she answered, "we couldn't. My aunt would be desolated by such a necessity. He is very influential in certain quarters. My aunt wants to catch him for the... He's going to write an article."
"He writes too many articles," the Duke said, with heavy displeasure.
"Oh, he has written one too many," she answered, "but that can be traversed."
"But no one believes," the Duke objected. Rede's voice intermittently broke in upon his sotto voce, coming to our ears in gusts.
"Haven't I seen you? And then? And you offer me the cross? To bribe me to silence? Me?"
In the general turning of faces toward the window in which stood Rede and the other, mine turned too. Rede was a cadaverous, weather-worn, passion-worn individual, badger gray, and worked up into a grotesquely attitudinized fury of injured self-esteem. The other was a denationalized, shifty-eyed, sallow, gray-bearded governor of one of the provinces of the Système Groenlandais, had a closely barbered head, a bull neck, and a great belly. He cast furtive glances round him, uncertain whether to escape or to wait for his say. He looked at the ring that encircled the window at a little distance, and his face, which had betrayed a half-apparent shame, hardened at sight of the cynical masks of the cosmopolitan conspirators. They were amused by the scene. The Holsteiner gained confidence, shrugged his shoulders.
"You have had the fever very badly since you came back," he said, showing a level row of white teeth. "You did not talk like that out there."
"No, pas si bête. You would have hanged me, perhaps, as you did that poor devil of a Swiss. What was his name? Now you offer me the cross, because I had the fever, eh?"
I'd been watching the Duke's face, A first red flush had come creeping from under the roots of his beard and had spread over the low forehead and the sides of the neck. The eyeglass fell from the eye, a signal for the color to retreat. The full lips grew pallid and began to mutter unspoken words. His eyes wandered appealingly from the woman beside him to me. I didn't want to look him in the face. The man was a trafficker in human blood, an evil liver, and I hated him. He had to pay his price, would have to pay. But I didn't want to see him pay it. There was a limit. I began to excuse myself and slid out between the groups of excellent plotters. As I was going, she said to me, "You may come to me tomorrow in the morning." End of The Inheritors, Chapter 11, by Joseph Conrad and Ford Maddox Ford.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app.
Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.